Yeah, that's a really powerful question.
That's a beautiful question.
That's a very wise question, Lauren.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio, and by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. I'm Lauren Korn, speaking with Ben Goldfarb, author of Crossings, How Road Ecology is Shaping the Future of Our Planet. In Crossings, Ben investigates how humans have altered the natural world. 1 million animals are killed by cars each day in the U.S. alone, but as the new science of road ecology shows, the harms of highways extend far beyond roadkill. Ben, thank you so much for being here. Welcome back to The Right Question.
Thanks, Lauren. I'm thrilled to be here.
If you're up for it, I thought a good way into our conversation today might be to read a piece from your introduction to Crossings. Will you read a short passage?
I would be honored, yeah. And just to set this up a little bit, this passage occurs when I'm describing my own origin story, how I got interested in this field of roads and wildlife. And I got this opportunity to take a tour of some wildlife crossings on Highway 93, just north of Missoula, on the Flathead Reservation with a guy named Marcel Hauser, who's a great road ecologist. And he took me up on one of these wildlife overpasses and was sort of trying to visualize how a black bear or an elk or a meadow vole might experience this built piece of infrastructure that helps animals move back and forth. So that's a little bit of preface that I think might help listeners understand what's going on here. Hauser, it occurred to me, was attempting to inhabit other beings' Umwelt, their subjective lived experience. Road ecology was an act of interspecies imagination, a field whose radical premise asserted that it was possible to perceive our built world through non-human eyes. How does a moose comprehend traffic? What sort of tunnel appeals to a mink? Why do grizzly bears prefer crossing over highways while black bears go under? These questions had empirical answers, but they also required ecologists to think like wild animals. Empathy manifested as science. To us, roads are so mundane they're practically invisible. To wildlife, they're utterly alien. Other species perceive the world through senses we cannot fathom and experience stressors and enticements we hardly register. Bats are lured astray by streetlights. Snails desiccate as they slog across deserts of asphalt, and seabirds crash land on the shiny tarmac they mistake for the ocean. Consider the sensory experience of, say, a fox approaching a highway. The eerie linear clearing that gashes the landscape. The acrid stench of tar and blood. The blinding lights staring from the faces of thundering predators. When Hazel, the rabbit protagonist of Watership Down, encounters his first road, he confuses it for a river, quote, black, smooth, and straight between its banks. A passing car fills the whole world with noise and fear. Now that I've learned about it, he adds, I want to get away from it as soon as I can.
Roadkill, sound, all of these different ways that animals are interacting with roads and roads are interacting or acting on animals, it's a huge impact, or it contributes to what we know is kind of this climate crisis or an environmental crisis, right? Will you talk about that scale, the what I'll call like a microcosmic, the roadkill being microcosmic of this larger problem, the macrocosmic environmental problem?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that in part because roadkill, like roads themselves are so ubiquitous, right? We have this way of ignoring them. You know, I think we have to blind ourselves to the scale of the carnage in some ways in order to just function and exist in modernity. So we've desensitized ourselves, I think, in some way to the dead deer or elk or raccoon or other animals. Perhaps as a result of that, you know, we tend to overlook roadkill as an environmental or ecological crisis, right? When we think about, you know, the forces that are killing wildlife, you know, maybe we think about poaching or deforestation or dams or certainly climate change. And obviously, all of those are crises in their own right. And yet, there's literally nothing that we do that kills more wild animals directly than drive. You know, it's this, this activity we do every single day without really thinking about it. And it's wreaking unbelievable havoc on nature. You know, and I think that one of the really pernicious things about roads and roadkill is, you know, it has this, roads have this way of concealing their own death and destruction, right? I mean, you know, you think about being sealed in your little glass and metal bubble of the, you know, the automobile, and you're just racing along at 70 miles an hour. And so that speed is what's obliterating animals, but it's also hiding those carcasses from us, right? We're trapped in our little bubbles cruising along. And, you know, maybe we see the dead deer and elk, the big critters, but we don't see all of the songbirds or the snakes or the rodents. You know, all the other smaller lives out there. And it's not until, you know, you get out on the highway on foot or by bicycle that you start to see some of those smaller animals and just truly recognize, you know, the scale of the problem we've created for wildlife.
And on the other side of that coin, though, being in cars, that is one way that people experience wildlife. I'm thinking, you know, here in Montana, we have Glacier National Park. There's this thing that you mentioned in the book, windshield tourism. Will you talk a little bit about that and where that kind of plays into this idea?
Well, think about all of our national parks. You know, they're fundamentally automotive spaces, right? Yeah. They're places that we're meant to experience from inside a car. And look, that's kind of awesome, right? I love those places. You know, I love going to Glacier. I love Yellowstone. You know, I love Yosemite and Denali and, you know, and the rest of these just incredible ecosystems and landscapes, right? The national parks road trip is sort of this fundamental American rite of passage in some ways. I mean, where else can approach a bison, our national mammal, you know, besides from behind the wheel in Yellowstone, right? So this experience of viewing landscapes and ecosystems and wildlife from behind a car, it's integral to how we understand nature, even as, you know, those same roads and cars are destroying nature, right? I think that's, you know, one of the great ironies of the National Park Service is, you know, here's this agency that for more than 100 years has been tasked with simultaneously, you know, providing for the enjoyment of visitors, of tourists, and conserving the wildlife within parks. And you know, and at times, those two missions are fundamentally at odds with each other.
Yeah, I do not envy the Park Service in that way.
It's a tough job, for sure.
Yeah, I can only imagine. You know, I was surprised, Ben, while reading Crossings, because one group I've never considered roadkill in the way that you talk about it in this book, insects, are roadkill. And they're so heavily, obviously, affected by the roadways, by cars. You write at great length about insects in a chapter titled Life on the Verge. And in that chapter, you write, a road isn't quite a place. But then later you write, roads were nature. So unpack those statements and what they have to do with insects.
Right. So, you know, in Montana, obviously, you guys are blessed with all of this incredible public land, right? There's all of this, you know, the national parks and national forests and BLM land, whereas, you know, many states don't have all of that public land as excellent habitat. So you think about, you know, Iowa or Illinois, you know, or Kansas, you know, these are all of these Midwestern states, you know, roadsides are often the largest form of public land out there, right? So much of the land is corn and soy monoculture or lawns, you know, in suburban areas. Mm-hmm. And so if you're, let's say, a monarch butterfly, you know, looking for a place to lay your eggs on some milkweed, you know, those roadsides, those strips of common land on either side of a highway might be one of your best options, right? So, you know, we think about roads as being fundamentally in opposition to ecosystems, but they're also ecosystems in their own right. And animals are kind of endlessly creative and flexible, and they'll use what we give them. And in many cases, what we're giving them are roadsides, you know, and so that's, you know, that's kind of the predicament that, you know, many monarch butterflies and other insects find themselves in the Midwest especially is, you know, they obviously they need habitat, you know, they need somewhere to go. And the road is the place where that habitat still exists on the landscape. And yet it's also very dangerous habitat, right? If you're a monarch butterfly, drifting through traffic to find a little patch of milkweed to lay your eggs, that's an immense challenge and is obviously very perilous. And, you know, as you say, we don't really consider insects roadkill. And yet millions of monarch butterflies are killed by cars every year, even as they're benefiting from the habitat that roads provide. And, you know, lots of animals are making that same trade-off. You know, you think about here in Montana, golden eagles or bald eagles or ravens or magpies. They're all of these scavengers, you know, who are taking advantage of this kind of carrion bounty that highways provide. But, you know, obviously, if you're a golden eagle with a belly full of venison, it's hard to achieve liftoff and, you know, you run the risk of being hit by a car yourself. So the road is an ecosystem, yes, but it's also a fundamentally dangerous ecosystem for everything from bald eagles to monarch butterflies.
And you speak to monarch butterflies directly in this book. And for the bigger animals that are being affected by roads, elk, deer, larger species, there are wildlife crossings being made all around the country. And we can speak to those. But when it comes to the animals in the air, how do we address that problem?
Yeah, it's a tough one. You know, there's in the book I briefly mentioned Taiwan, and Taiwan has the second largest butterfly migration in the world after monarchs. Moving through North America, they have these giant butterflies called purple crow butterflies, and they'll erect these giant nets on either side of highways during butterfly migration season to deflect the butterflies away from traffic. So good luck telling the Texas Department of Transportation that they're going to, net off thousands of miles of highway during butterfly migration. But, I do think it speaks to something real and important, which is that, in many cases, other countries are a little bit more thoughtful than we are about these sorts of problems. Yes, we have wildlife crossings. We've dealt with this issue in some places and in some ways. But, there are other places like India, for example, that actually elevate their highways for many miles in a stretch so that wild animals, especially tigers and elephants, can just walk back and forth underneath highways. And that's obviously much more expensive, but, they view that as kind of essential to preserving ecosystems. And, we don't quite have that same mentality here. So I think there's a lot we can learn from looking at other countries, whether it's Taiwan netting off its roadsides for butterflies or India elevating their highways for tigers.
Is that the answer? Elevating not only our roads, but elevating other species above the human, prioritizing other species? Is that the answer? And why can't the U.S. specifically, why can't we kind of fall in line in that way?
Yeah, I don't know if it's about elevating other species above humans necessarily. I just think it's about accommodating other species, right? And, look, one of the great challenges that we have here is that, we built our interstate highway system, back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, before we fully recognized the immense biological toll it was going to take, right? We built I-90 through Montana before we realized that it was going to be this absolutely insuperable barrier to dispersing grizzly bears, for example. Mm-hmm. We built I-80 through Wyoming before we recognized that it was going to cut off deer and elk and pronghorn migrations and, cause mass starvation among some herds of ungulates, right? So, so we're stuck with this really calcified infrastructure, in a sense. And, yes, we can retrofit it. We can put up overpasses here and there. We can enlarge bridges to allow animals to move under highways. But, by and large, we're just stuck with this concrete legacy. It costs a lot to deal with the legacy of that infrastructure. And so far, we haven't been quite willing to shoulder those costs on a truly massive scale.
You're listening to A Conversation with Ben Goldfarb. I'm Lauren Korn. This episode of The Right Question is supported by Bookworks of Whitefish, offering new books of all genres, stationery, and puzzles. Open 11 to 6 Monday through Saturday and located in downtown Whitefish, Montana in the 3rd and Spokane Building. the book, you talk about this overpass on Highway 93, and you call it one of North America's finest road ecology projects. So tell me about why this particular partnership, this particular project, has succeeded so significantly.
You know, certainly the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes get a huge amount of credit there, right?
Sure.
So the story is that, you know, Highway 93, as most listeners have probably experienced, you know, runs through the Flathead Reservation, right?
Yeah.
The traditional homeland of the Confederated Salish and Kootenai. And, you know, in the late 1990s and early 2000s, you know, the state of Montana and the federal government wanted to widen that highway, basically take a two-lane highway and make it a four-lane highway. And, you know, they're doing that primarily for driver safety, but, you know, the tribes also recognized that, you know, hey, a wider, faster highway is going to be much worse for bears and deer and elk and, you know, all of the critters that were so foundational to their culture. And so they basically insisted that, you know, that when the state did sort of reconstruct that highway, they include around 40 wildlife crossings, all of these different structures that, again, you know, allow animals to go safely back and forth with fences between them to guide the animals to the crossings. And you know, the tribes said something really beautiful at the time, which is that basically the road is a visitor that has to respect the spirit of the land and the place. And I thought that's such an incredibly beautiful sentiment, right? I mean, we think about roads as sort of these tools of conquest. You know, the U.S. Army built so many of them across the West in the early 1800s. That was how, you know, we white people basically settled and conquered the landscape. And, you know, and the tribes were essentially saying, hey, let's think about roads differently. Let's think about how they can visit the land instead of dominating it, and how they can be, you know, as benign as possible to wildlife rather than incredibly destructive. And so that idea of the road being a visitor led to those many wonderful wildlife crossings. And I think it's a pretty powerful concept the world over.
Yeah. So we've talked about wildlife crossings, these overpasses, underpasses. Let's talk about the idea of rewilding, taking out roads or highways.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we're not going to remove, you know, I-90 or Highway 93 or any of these big federal interstates or highways. But,
right,
you know, there are so many other roads out there, right? I think, unbeknownst to most people, the single largest road manager on Earth is the U.S. Forest Service. You know, there's something like 370,000 miles of Forest Service road out there. And a lot of them are, you know, old derelict logging roads that, you know, don't see a lot of traffic. And yet they still have all kinds of environmental impacts. You know, they often sort of hemorrhage sediment into the environment. You know, you get a big snowmelt or rainfall event and those dirt roads just turn liquid. And, you know, smother fish eggs and larvae or amphibian larvae as well. You know, often those roads, even though they don't get a whole lot of traffic, you know, they allow humans into nature, and you know, that can spell trouble for grizzly bears or lynx or wolverines or elk or, you know, or bull trout, any of these sensitive species, right? So there's lots of scientific research basically showing that, you know, as road networks become more dense in habitats, you know, the quality of that habitat for lots of different species declines. And so one of the best things we can do to protect a lot of those sensitive species that, you know, Montana is still so fortunate to have, unlike so many other places, is to remove some of those roads. And, you know, I spent a lot of time in Montana working on this book in, you know, the Lolo and Helena National Forests, where road decommissioning, the obliteration of old forest roads is in full swing. And, you know, basically there's, you know, heavy machinery out there just clawing the roadbed up, decompacting the soil, allowing plants to take root, and basically taking that road that's had so many harmful ecological impacts for so long and returning it to nature and allowing the forest to reclaim it.
Ben, a part of me wants to make a joke out of my next question, but I'm hoping you will contextualize it for our listeners. How did the salamander cross the road?
Very slowly.
Yeah.
You know, it's I'm glad you asked about that because, you know, I think that amphibians, you know, salamanders and frogs and toads, you know, they really don't get a lot of attention, right? Both among the sort of general public, but also among road ecologists, or at least historically that was the case. Because look, you know, you think about the way that a lot of our transportation departments view this problem, right? You know, a lot of engineers, I would say, think about the problem of wildlife vehicle collisions as being one of human safety fundamentally, right? That these crashes are bad because they endanger human lives. You know, nobody wants to hit a deer or an elk. You know, hundreds of drivers die in these crashes every year. You know, the average elk collision costs society more than $20,000. And so, you know, if you build wildlife crossings that prevent crashes featuring large, dangerous, expensive ungulates, you know, you can really... you know, those crossings really pencil out from a cost-benefit standpoint as well as a conservation standpoint, mm-hmm. which is great. You know, we certainly need more deer and elk passages. But, you know, it also means that when we take that cost-benefit-focused perspective on this issue, you know, we forget about all of those smaller animals that, you know, nobody's ever totaled their car hitting a spotted salamander or a garter snake. But, you know, those are some of the most road endangered animals out there. You know, I mean, amphibians especially, which have to migrate across roads to reach their breeding ponds. You know, animals like the boreal toad here in Montana. And so, you know, we haven't really done a whole lot of mitigation for those animals because, again, they're not a threat to us as drivers. But, you know, dealing with the impacts of roads really means thinking about those smaller critters. So let's build more deer and elk passages, definitely, but let's also build tunnels for toads and salamanders and frogs as well, as they've done, you know, in Massachusetts and Vermont and a couple of other places.
Amazing. Conversations about the environment, conversations about infrastructure, conversations about conservation, these are all ultimately, and maybe unfortunately, but they're all political conversations. And they end sort of in like governmental and political spaces. Crossings is inherently about borders and boundaries. And I'm wondering how you think about political borders and boundaries when it comes to crossings and how maybe you've decided to address those in the book.
That's a good question. I mean, you know, there are a couple of places that, you know, my mind goes when you ask that question. You know, the first is the impact of border infrastructure, right? You know, we know that fences are another linear feature that cuts across the landscape and prevents animals from moving. And, you know, all over the world, countries are hardening their border infrastructure, right? And obviously we're seeing that at the southern border, you know, where the border wall is increasingly an obstacle to the movement of jaguars and mountain lions and ocelots and, you know, and even beavers, you know, one of my favorite critters.
Yeah, of course.
You know, which live in the kind of the binational San Pedro River. So that's, you know, that's and look, certainly it's not that problem is not isolated to the U.S. You know,
right.
We're seeing, for example, China fortify its border with Mongolia, which has had huge impacts on Mongolian gazelles, right? So this, you know, this kind of increasing nationalism that we see all over the world, you know, has immense impacts for wildlife. But, you know, as you think about the kind of the political repercussions or connections of this issue, you know, I think that's one of the things that drew me to this topic is actually how apolitical or nonpartisan it is, right? Mm. You know, look, we know that nobody wants to hit a deer or an elk, regardless of their political leanings. And in fact, in places like Wyoming, you know, the hunters have been the most forceful lobbyists for new wildlife crossings.
Wow, yeah.
You know, in Colorado, where I live, 85% of residents support more wildlife crossings, right? And you couldn't get 85% of Coloradans to agree that the sky is blue, you know? This is truly an issue that crosses or transcends political lines. And, you know, we live in this hyper-polarized world, obviously, and in wildlife crossings and, you know, the ability of animals to move safely around the landscape. You know, that's something that on some level, you know, virtually everybody can get behind.
As much as crossings is about the effect and the effects that roadways and highways have on the non-human world, you do spend a fair amount of time outlining the ways that they've affected marginalized communities around the world as well. And you write that, quote, although nearly all humans are touched by roads, we're not touched equally. So tell me and our listeners about how road ecology intersects air pollution and the very deliberate fragmentation of communities of color.
Yeah, you know, that really dates back to the middle of the 20th century when you know, the Federal Highway Administration and various cities were kind of figuring out, you know, where the new interstate highways were going to go. And, you know, a lot of white city planners and I mean, look, name a city, you know, from Minneapolis to Miami to Los Angeles, basically said, hey, you know, these new highways that are going to be routed through our communities are, unfortunately, an opportunity to basically clear out some of the communities of color that, you know, we don't want in our cities, or so those planners thought. Yeah. And, you know, highways were used as this tool of, as they put it, urban renewal, you know, a chance to just wipe away neighborhoods they perceived as undesirable. And, you know, and again, I mean, this happened in so many American cities where, you know, these interstates, these urban freeways were used as erasers, essentially, to, you know, to wipe out neighborhoods of color. And you know, today, as you alluded to, you know, we know that people of color have disproportionate rates of living close to freeways still. They have disproportionate rates of asthma and cancer and all kinds of, you know, health problems that that result. You know, they're disproportionately exposed to noise and air pollution. And so, you know, this legacy of highways is really kind of a legacy of infrastructural racism. And, you know, those decisions that were made 75 years ago still ramify on the landscape today. And, you know, that's a lot of what this book's about, as you say, is, you know, the connections between humans and natural ecosystems and how roads affect us analogously, right? Mm. That, you know, that they fragment forests and wetlands and deserts, and they also fragment cities and communities. And, you know, in some ways, you know, the work of urban advocates and the work of road ecologists is the same work. It's about creating a world that's less prisoner to roads and cars, a world that both humans and deer and grizzly bears can safely navigate on foot.
I love a certain line in Crossings. You write about the 1980s that, quote, highways were valuable habitat for the same reason humans prized them, their connectivity. And this is another way to say that roads are part of an ecosystem or many ecosystems. And we've been talking about that intersection as mainly a negative thing. Are there ways roads are a good thing for animals? And maybe a peripheral question to that is, like, how do we find hope through this science of road ecology?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, look, certainly, you know, there are beneficiaries. You know, we know that animals, again, they're, you know, they're incredibly creative and adaptive and flexible. You know, there's a very famous population of urban coyotes in Chicago who cross at the crosswalks at the red light and, you know, look both ways, right? Which, yeah, not all human pedestrians do. So, you know, certainly there are critters that are capable of taking advantage of roads. And, you know, I think that the hope that road ecology provides is that, you know, it shows us how to provide more opportunities for those animals, right? I mean, you know, not every animal is as flexible as a vulture or as intelligent as a coyote. But, you know, I think we can learn from those critters and, again, you know, recognize that there is a way for our infrastructure and our natural wild communities to cohabitate. But, you know, it requires a lot of investment and thoughtfulness.
That was Ben Goldfarb, author of Crossings, How Road Ecology is Shaping the Future of Our Planet, out now in paperback from W.W. Norton & Company. Look for more information about Ben at mtpr.org, where you can also listen to his conversation with Sarah Aronson about his previous book, Eager, The Surprising Secret Life of Beavers and Why They Matter. While you're there, you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and Instagram. You've been listening to The Right Question. This episode was produced by Chris Moyles and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Chris also engineered this episode. The artwork for The Right Question was designed by Molly Russell. Funding for The Right Question is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008. And thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.